Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
A quick anecdote before I begin. Thomas Aquinas and the Philosophy of the Punishment, the Philosophy of Punishment is the title of a book that I published back in 2012 with the Catholic University of America Press. And writing a book on what a medieval philosopher and theologian can contribute to the modern discussion of punishment is particularly challenging because, of course, the Middle Ages is a time that is ill-reputed for things like the rack and the disemboweling of heretics and so on. And to try to explain to a modern audience how a medieval philosopher could possibly have something to contribute to the subject of punishment is particularly challenging. And so I had to spend considerable time in the beginning pages of that book explaining to my audience how it is that St. Thomas Aquinas's theory of natural law, of justice, of the common good, actually can bring something to bear upon this perennial question. So you could probably imagine my surprise when I saw the proposed cover art of the book presented to me by the Catholic University of America Press, which was a little bit hard to make out at first, but when I got a little closer look at it, I noticed that it was a relief of King Louis IX branding with a hot iron a blasphemer on the lips. And that was quite shocking and was probably running a little counter to my purposes in the book. Unfortunately, it was too late to change it, and so there was the cover art for Thomas Aquinas and the Philosophy of Punishment. So I'm going to talk a lot tonight about something that has been referred to as retributive justice. And the opening section of this talk is subtitled The Plight of Retributive Justice. So in 1949, C.S. Lewis first published an essay entitled The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment, in which he argued for what he called a more traditional retributive theory of punishment in favor of, or as opposed to, what he called the humanitarian theory of punishment. As Lewis argued, whereas many have dismissed the concept of retribution as nothing more than a veil for vengeance and barbarism, it turns out upon analysis that it's actually removing retribution from our notion of criminal justice. That is what has truly had a perverse and dehumanizing effect on our institutions of penal law. Especially striking is Lewis's claim that retribution is important not just from the point of view of the law, but also from the point of view of the criminal. Once the concept of retribution is removed and we're left only with the humanitarian goals of deterrence and rehabilitation, each one of us is, Lewis says, from the moment he breaks the law, deprived of the rights of a human being. How is this so? It seems very counterintuitive. According to Lewis, the problem with the humanitarian theory of punishment is that it removes from punishment the concept of desert, a concept that is, quote, the only connecting link between punishment and justice. As he explains, it's only as deserved or undeserved that a punishment can be just or unjust. There's no sense in talking about a just deterrent or a just cure. We demand of a deterrent not whether it is just, but whether it will deter. And we demand of a cure not whether it is just, but whether it succeeds. Thus, when we cease to consider what the criminal deserves and consider only what will cure him or deter others, we have tacitly removed him from the sphere of justice altogether. Instead of a person, he becomes a subject of rights, he now becomes a mere object, a patient, a case. A criminal, therefore, at the mercy of a humanitarian system of punishment, will have his fate decided by experts in psychotherapy and psychology, rather than by judges trained in jurisprudence. Instead of a definite sentence imposed by such a judge, the criminal will receive an indefinite sentence that is only lifted when the so-called expert considers him cured. Followed consistently, the humanitarian theory might impose a much more severe penalty upon a harmless but difficult to cure criminal than upon a murderer that is cured relatively quickly. The fact that such disparity of punishment strikes decent human beings as alarmingly unfair is really beside the point. To the experts, fairness is just another word for justice, a notion inseparable from the belief that criminals should be punished no less and no more than what they deserved. And it's precisely this understanding of desert that the humanitarian theory's apologists consider meaningless and aim to replace. Lewis goes on to argue that the problems with eliminating retribution are even worse when one considers deterrence. Here, the eclipse of justice is even more evident. As Lewis puts it, when deterrence becomes the sole or even the primary goal of punishment, it is not absolutely necessary that the man we punish should even have committed the crime. The punishment of a man actually guilty, whom the public think innocent, will not have the desired effect. The punishment of a man actually innocent will, provided the public think he's guilty. To be sure, supporters of the humanitarian theory of punishment have argued that punishing an innocent person to achieve a deterrent effect would never be worth the risk of the general public finding out the truth. But Lewis, for his part, insists that every modern state has powers which make it easy to fake a trial, and that when a victim is urgently needed for exemplary purposes of deterrence, deterrence will be equally served by the punishment of an innocent victim. In the end, it probably doesn't even matter so much to Lewis how likely the scenario is in the real world. The mere fact that something is startlingly wrong as the punishment of the innocent could be justified, even in principle, by the humanitarian theory is enough in his mind to discredit it. Whether we consider rehabilitation or deterrence, therefore, letting go of the idea that criminals should be punished because they deserve it easily opens the door to punishing people far greater than what justice requires. Which one of us, if he stood in the dock, Lewis provocatively asks, would not prefer to be tried by the old, that is, retributive system? To be sure, some aspects of Lewis's essay are reminiscent of Immanuel Kant's theory of retributivism, or his argument for retributivism, such as Lewis's complaint that the humanitarian theory of punishment uses the criminal as a mere means to an end, someone else's end. But much more prominent are his frequent references or allusions to natural law, a much older tradition, and one that Lewis clearly intends to represent. This explains Lewis's criticism of the humanitarian theory of punishment on the grounds that it turns the responsibility of sentencing criminals over to psychologists and social scientists, rather than leaving it with judges trained in jurisprudence who take their guidance, he says, from the law of nature. The position he lays out stands in stark contrast to the prevailing belief in modern political philosophy that the very notion of retributive justice is incoherent. For example, in chapter 13 of his famous Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, Jeremy Bentham carefully applies the principles of utilitarianism, developed earlier in the book, to the institution of punishment. In order to have any moral justification whatsoever, he argues, punishment must look forward to some identifiable good for society to be obtained in the future, which limits us to pursuing rehabilitation, deterrence, and thirdly, the physical sequestering of dangerous criminals from society, something Bentham calls disablement. Retribution, as he sees it, looks backwards, not forwards, as it attempts to pay back the criminals for the criminal for his crime. It is essentially, for Bentham, the outgrowth of anger and other subrational urges, and must therefore be suppressed rather than indulged by the law. In a very revealing footnote, Bentham identifies natural law theory as at least partially responsible for the bogus notion of retribution, because in his mind, the natural feelings of resentment and hatred that we feel as a response to injustice is legitimized by any theory like natural law that sees nature as morally normative. As he mockingly describes the natural law defense of retribution, quote, "If you hate much, punish much. If you hate little, punish little. Punish as you hate." The attempt by modern political theory to eradicate retributive justice from our political institutions has led some to argue that modern liberal states are, in fact, incapable of truly punishing criminals because they have transformed punishment into restitution or reduced it to a kind of social hygiene. It would be well to recall, however, that removing retribution from one's philosophical theory of punishment vastly predates the advent of liberal or even modern political thought. In fact, we may observe the emphatically illiberal and pre-modern Plato doing just this as he formulated his own theory of punishment in his Laws, his last and most extensive political dialogue that deals with the question of punishment. Now, the Laws of Plato has long been recognized, in contrast to the much more widely known and studied Republic, which sets forth Plato's idea of the simply best regime. That is, the best regime we may reasonably hope could come to exist among actual human beings. The Laws is the only dialogue from which Socrates is entirely absent. Entirely absent. There are other dialogues where he doesn't speak, but he's at least referred to, you know, in the third person. But he's entirely absent from the Laws. Although the role of primary interlocutor, usually assumed by Socrates, is filled by an emphatically Socrates-like Athenian stranger who goes unnamed, who engages in an extremely long and detailed discussion of law with a Cretan named Cleinias and a Spartan named Megillus. All three interlocutors are in their old age, and it appears as though Plato's wish is to underscore the realism of the Laws, as opposed to the Republic, in which philosophers very unrealistically rule as kings. When he has Cleinias reveal at the end of Book 3 that he's been appointed to a commission actually assigned with the task of drafting a legal code for a new Cretan colony, this revelation motivates the three men all the more to devise laws that will work in real life and among men that we may not assume display an excellent or even a very good moral character. In fact, one might even suggest that the law's very emphasis upon the rule of law is already a kind of concession to the real-life challenges of statecraft, challenges that are largely ignored in the Republic on account of a much younger Socrates' attempt to reveal only the very zenith of human potential. Even if it's simply better to be ruled by wise philosophers, it is much more realistic to establish wise laws that will be respected even in the much more likely times when good rulers are in short supply. So the political realism of the Laws also explains the Athenian stranger's extended discussion of punishment, which had no counterpart in the Republic. It was never really brought up even. Beginning in Book 9, the stranger recognizes, albeit reluctantly, that political regimes comprised of humans will always deal with unjust souls who violate the law. As the Athenian stranger explains, quote, "It is indeed in a certain way shameful even to legislate all the things we're now about to lay down. In a city such as this, which we claim will be well administered and correctly equipped in every way for the practice of virtue, even to assume that in such a city someone may grow up who shares in the wickedness of the greatest of other places, so that it's necessary to have legislation that anticipates and threatens such a man. If he comes into being to lay down laws to deter these men and punish them when they do arise, as if they are going to arise, it is, as I say, in a certain way shameful. But we aren't in the same position as were the ancient lawgivers, who gave their laws to heroes, the children of gods. We are human. We are humans, and legislating now for the seed of humans." And that's the end of the quote. Given that the Athenian stranger will have to stoop so low as to make laws for those who defy justice, however, we are given to understand that this will not be just any ordinary criminal code. In fact, he even asserts that the establishment of punitive laws, quote, "has never been worked out correctly in any way, ever, by any man in the history of lawmaking." These remarks come, of course, during the well-known preludes to the criminal code. Now, throughout the entire dialogue of the laws, all of the city's laws have been prefaced, or had been prefaced, by these preludes, on the grounds that free human beings should not simply be commanded to behave in this way or that as slaves, but should have the wisdom of the laws explained to them, using, as the stranger conspicuously adds, arguments that come close to philosophizing. As a result, the stranger must provide a theory of punishment prior to providing a criminal code. He must explain to Cleinias and Megillus the ultimate purpose of punishment in light of the city's highest aspirations and a true understanding of the human soul, as opposed to a simplistic, corrupt, or simply false understanding. On this score, the stranger does not disappoint. Punishment, he asserts, must be forward-facing. No judicial punishment that takes place according to law, he says, aims at what is bad, but for the most part accomplishes one of two aims. It makes the one who receives the judicial punishment either better or less wicked. So in this respect, he agrees with Bentham. Punishment must look forward. Thus, he reveals what we might call his enlightened theory of punishment, because it is exclusively devoted to curing the criminal of the moral disease that caused him to commit the crime in the first place. Retribution, therefore, has no place. It is completely airbrushed out. The stranger's penology is thoroughly therapeutic, with the moral reform of the criminal as the primary objective. The stranger's remarks here cannot be fully appreciated without understanding the psychological basis upon which they rest, namely the well-known Socratic teaching that no one ever does injustice willingly or voluntarily, or that all moral wrongdoing is ultimately reducible to ignorance, just as all virtue is reducible to knowledge. This is Socrates' famous view. This principle had already been set forth in Book 5 of the Laws, not to mention numerous other Platonic dialogues, but it's now applied to that part of the city whereupon it stands to have the greatest legislative impact, the criminal code. As a result, the stranger's prelude consistently replaces the distinction between more or less voluntary crimes in which the criminal is, with the distinction of crimes that are more or less curable. As Socrates had insisted to Polemarchus early in the Republic, true justice would never seek to inflict harm in any way. And in the same way, the stranger's approach to punishment is thoroughly benevolent. Because all crime, inasmuch as it's truly unjust, flows from an ignorance as to that in which the criminal's true good consists, the only reasonable punishment is the eradication of that ignorance through instruction, that is, enlightenment. The more difficult to cure the ignorance, presumably, the more instruction is necessary. This line of reasoning reaches its logical conclusion, then, when the stranger insists that, for those judged to be thoroughly incurable or unteachable, the only possible recourse is the death penalty. Not, of course, as a penalty in the traditional sense, but as one commentator puts it, the response of the city to one who simply cannot live in it. The stranger's theory of punishment, one might say, is one in which we observe the complete dominance of reason, or, to use Plato's word, logos. It is entirely rooted in what logos reveals to be the true source of crime and injustice, namely, ignorance of the true good for man. Additionally, the stranger insists that if a criminal is deficient in justice, that can only be explained by the fact that he is equally deficient in logos. And so instruction, even with arguments that come close to philosophizing, is the only reasonable response. If logos is what the stranger's theory of punishment highlights, however, we may find it equally remarkable that his discussion abstracts from, or even eclipses, another part of the soul, equally relevant to the punishing of criminals, namely, thumos. This is a part of the soul mentioned frequently in Book 9 of the Laws, often as something, when combined with ignorance, plays a role in causing criminal behavior. But those familiar with Plato will also remember that thumos is a critical dimension of all human souls, as it's discussed in great detail in The Republic. Translating thumos as spiritedness, and identifying it as the psychological basis of human anger and human righteous indignation. The great Plato scholar and translator Alan Bloom describes it in the following terms. Thumos is very much connected with the defense of one's own. If we take Achilles as the model of the spirited or thumotic man, we see that anger is particularly directed towards punishment of those who take away one's own or threaten it. Although anger causes men to be willing to sacrifice life, it is somehow connected with preserving those things that make life possible. Now, it is the nature of human anger to seek for justification. It's difficult for a man to be angry when he's convinced that what is taken from him does not belong to him, or that his losses or sufferings are his own fault. Anger requires something to blame, and it attributes responsibility to what injures, and is closely allied with the sense of justice and injustice. That's the end of the quote from Bloom. Perhaps the most important observations here are the fact that thumos is, A, deeply present in our pre-reflective sense of justice, and B, strongly inclined to attribute responsibility or blame to its object. I mean, you even do that, sort of incidentally when you stub your toe. You get mad at the door frame very instantaneously, and then you realize how ridiculous that is. But for a split second, you attributed moral culpability to that door frame. That's thumos. Given that not only criminals, but the majority of the law-abiding citizens in the city of the laws are given to thumos and its effects, the Athenian stranger's theory of punishment begins to appear in some sense hostile to the deeply held moral sentiments of most people. Most blatantly, the belief that no injustice is committed voluntarily is one that very few people, even remotely victimized by injustice, could ever accept. That those who seriously harm our fellow citizens, or even us, are merely cured with education is rejected by Thumos. It's rejected as an affront to justice. And the stranger's penology appears as much a cruel mockery of a criminal's victims as it is an undeserved gift to the criminal himself. Is it really wise, even assuming the truth of the philosophical truth contained in the stranger's prelude to the criminal law, to establish an actual penal code that contains a suppression of such a fundamental part of the human soul? The stranger's answer, perhaps surprisingly, seems to be no. In fact, the penal code that follows his prelude appears in many ways to constitute a significant retraction of the criminological theory that he provided earlier. This is not to say that the stranger doubts whether his theory of punishment and the psychological basis of crime is true. It's to suggest, rather, however much that theory accords with reason, that it's likely, if implemented, to be quite harmful to a city inhabited by citizens subject to powerful subrational forces. For temple robbery, the crime that would certainly invoke the righteous indignation of patriotic citizens more than any other, the stranger interestingly asserts that perpetrators are to be automatically declared incurable and put to death, which is also the fate of those convicted of treason. Following this, the stranger puts forward a fairly conventional punishment for theft, a fine that's twice the value of the item stolen, or imprisonment if the thief is unable to pay. Interestingly, and in spite of the earlier claim that all crime is involuntary, the stranger now sharply distinguishes between voluntary and involuntary killing. Completely contradicts himself. Less severe penalties are given for sudden crimes of passion than for premeditated murder. Presumably, the difference in penalties may still be defended under the standard of reforming the criminal where possible, but it becomes increasingly difficult to see how the punishments assigned reflect the enlightened theory of punishment that he had articulated earlier. In fact, many of the punishments appear to serve the purpose not of enlightenment or education, but as a kind of ritual purification or even atonement for the crime committed. In short, the penal code is far less offensive to the demands of Thumos than was the stranger's prelude. We can observe this most clearly by recalling the strong tendency of Thumos to attribute moral responsibility to that which harms us, which coheres well with the stranger's suggestion that the city should even go so far as to punish wild beasts and even inanimate objects, presumably stones or large tiles that murder citizens by attacking them from falling on them from above. With these and other punishments that could have no possible rehabilitative or educative effect, it seems that the stranger has all but abandoned the principles that he established at the outset, and has done so precisely as a concession to Thumos and to the Thumotic men who will inhabit the city whose laws they now construct. Again, none of this is to suggest that a flaw in the stranger's or Plato's theory of punishment. The glaring inconsistency between the theory and the practice of Book 9 of the Laws is no doubt intended to be instructive to us, the reader. Most of all, it reveals Plato's crucial insight into the notion of retribution. As contemporary Plato scholar Bradley Lewis summarizes, retribution is a kind of natural human impulse in reaction to damage done to oneself or things that one cares about. The desire to return like for like is related to the fundamental impulses of justice, And even if the higher aims of reform are given precedence, one must be content to channel rather than simply eliminate the need for retributive punishment. The Athenian stranger of Plato's laws recognizes this when his theoretical discussion of punishment is based upon the priority of reform, but the actual punishments that follow recognize without comment the inescapable force of retributive justice. Now, in moving from Plato's nuanced view of criminal justice to that of Thomas Aquinas, we move from that which we may call a classical political rationalism and a healthy dose of realism to a theologically grounded understanding of natural law. As I argued in my aforementioned book, Thomas Aquinas and the Philosophy of Punishment, nearly everything that St. Thomas Aquinas says about punishment must be understood through the lens of natural law, which is grounded by an understanding of God as the creator of the world, ex nihilo, who provided and who providently and benevolently sustains that world in being. Natural law is, in fact, defined as nothing other than the human participation in the eternal law, which is understood by St. Thomas as God's providence over creation that endows each thing with the particular nature it has. So, just as plants and irrational animals may either flourish or become stifled in fulfilling their natures, so also may human beings, with the enormously important caveat that our own choices ultimately determine whether we follow or deviate from the eternal law in which we participate. Hence, the natural law is also a moral law, and the standard determining the goodness or badness of all human actions and institutions. These fundamentals of St. Thomas's natural law teaching, of course, leave open the question as to how we human beings come to know what the natural law actually requires. The requirements of morality are presumably knowable quite apart from, for example, divine commandments, however much those commandments may reinforce the natural law. So St. Thomas is fond of quoting St. Paul's letter to the Romans. Quote, when the Gentiles who have not the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law unto themselves, and they show that what the law requires is written on their hearts. In one of the most disputed passages in his entire corpus, St. Thomas famously argues that the precepts of the natural law may be derived from natural inclinations of human beings. Inclinations that include the human tendency to preserve human life and to ward off obstacles to that preservation, to procreate and to protect offspring, to pursue knowledge, to shun ignorance, and to avoid harming those with whom we live. To be sure, just exactly how following our natural inclinations could lead us to morally instructive precepts has been the subject of decades of debate among Thomists. And even to begin down that road would waste precious time here. It is noteworthy, however, that St. Thomas raises an objection to his position in which the objector points out a potential problem with looking to the numerous inclinations of human nature in order to derive moral precepts, because that would mean that, quote, even things related to the inclination of the concupiscible faculty would then belong to the natural law. In his reply, St. Thomas interestingly does not deny that inclinations of concupiscence belong to the natural law, but he adds that they do so only insofar as they are ruled by reason. This makes good sense of St. Thomas's reference to concupiscence in other places outside the treatise on law. For example, his explanation of the sinfulness of gluttony, which consists in inordinate concupiscence, as when we eat or drink in a way that is disproportionate with the due end for which eating and drinking are naturally established, namely the sustaining of our physical life and health. Hence, we are given to understand that precepts of the natural law are derived from natural inclination by reason's ability to discern a kind of inner logic in that natural inclination, in the inclinations themselves. In the case of gluttony, the inner logic is fairly straightforward. We have a strong inclination to eat and drink because doing so is necessary for our survival and our physical health. And so to eat or drink in a way that is disproportionate to that end is a contravention of the natural law, and therefore morally bad. St. Thomas argues along very similar lines in his discussion of sexual morality and other virtues and vices having to do with concupiscence and the virtue of moderation. Given, therefore, that the central role of natural law and natural inclination in St. Thomas's moral philosophy, we should expect any discussion of the moral basis of punishment to be explained in similar terms. In St. Thomas's discussion of natural law, there is no explicit mention of a natural inclination to punish wrongdoers. In his discussion of punishment, however, we find just this. The text is admittedly a strange one and in need of careful analysis. It goes like this. It has passed from natural things to human affairs that whenever one thing rises up against another, it suffers some detriment therefrom. For we observe in natural things that when one contrary supervenes, the other acts with greater energy, for which reason hot water freezes more rapidly. Wherefore, we find that the natural inclination of man is to repress those who rise up against him. Now, it is evident that all things contained in an order are, in a manner, one in relation to the principle of that order. Consequently, whatever rises up against an order is put down by that order or by some principle thereof. And because sin is an inordinate act, it's evident that whoever sins commits an offense against an order. Wherefore, he is put down in consequence by that same order, which repression is punishment. That's the end of the text. It's crucial to note here that the question St. Thomas is addressing here is whether there exists a debt of punishment. In other words, he's addressing the fundamental question as to whether it's true to say that certain actions bring about in the one performing those actions a deservingness of punishment upon the agent himself. His answer for why they do shows us the basis of St. Thomas Aquinas' retributive theory of punishment. It appeals to what we've already seen is the basis for the natural law, namely natural inclinations, and in this case, the natural inclination to repress those who rise up against us. This is an inclination, moreover, that St. Thomas says has passed from natural things, from things we are given to understand that have no share in reason. And although we must order these inclinations in accordance with reason, they are profoundly connected to the sub-rational life of the human being. If we investigate what St. Thomas says here in relation to his broader philosophical anthropology, it becomes quite clear that what he refers to as the natural inclination to repress those who rise up against us is, in fact, not the concupiscible faculty, but what he calls the irascible faculty, or the irascible appetite of the human soul. A faculty that just so happens to correspond to what Plato called thumos. If I may be permitted to paraphrase my own summary in the book Thomas Aquinas and the Philosophy of Punishment, the irascible faculty offers resistance against corruptive and contrary agencies that are a hindrance to the acquisition of what is suitable and productive of harm. Thus understood, the irascible faculty follows upon the concupiscible and could not exist without it, since the obstacles it fights against are precisely those which stand to prevent us from obtaining our concupiscible desires, those things that we love. This is why St. Thomas argues that the irascible faculty is the champion and defender of the concupiscible faculty, and is expressed primarily in passions such as hatred and anger, the latter of which naturally seeks to inflict a punitive evil upon its object. The irascible faculty exists in all animals possessing a sensitive appetite, and even a semblance of it is found in inanimate things, such as fire, which resists whatever destroys or hinders its action. An example that bears a striking similarity to the one that we just saw in St. Thomas's explanation of the debt of punishment, according to which hot water freezes more rapidly. So without question, such an appeal to natural inclinations, and particularly those emerging from the subrational, appears to play straight into the hands of Bentham's mockery, the natural law and the justifications for punishment. If you hate much, punish much. If you hate little. Punish as you hate. Of course, the argument behind Bentham's mockery is that natural law theory is hostile to reason because it prefers to pursue the objects of our subrational urges and desires. But if we recall St. Thomas's account, his account of concupiscence, we see that Bentham's criticism notwithstanding, reason holds a place of prominence. Our desires for food, for drink, for sex are guided by what reason can discern is the true end of those desires in the first place. We can see as rational beings why we have them and pursue them accordingly. Reason is able, therefore, to set limits on how a moral agent should pursue his or her natural inclinations by ordering his own ends to those of nature itself. Now, in the case of the concupiscible inclinations, these ends are fairly easy to discern. Life and health in the case of food and drink, procreation in the case of sex. But what about natural irascible inclination to repress those who rise up against the political order? This is not so straightforward. On one hand, we might say that such inclinations are given by God simply to motivate us to protect the political community, to protect it from harm, from dangerous criminals. But this, I think, would be too simplistic. Punishment, on St. Thomas's view, is not justified merely as it incapacitates or renders harmless an otherwise harmful criminal. Besides this, St. Thomas repeatedly contrasts the vindication of justice by means of punishment with punishment's medicinal aspects, such as rehabilitation and deterrence. Unfortunately, St. Thomas does not leave us with a very full account of what actual good for society the punitive inclinations serve, and so we are left to speculate to some degree. I'll entertain briefly two possible answers to this question. One answer is to say that punishment simply serves the good of reestablishing the equality of justice. And to be sure, St. Thomas himself speaks of punishment precisely in these terms on many occasions. To leave it just at this, however, strikes me, anyway, as somewhat question-begging. What I mean is this: how does the performance of a criminal act create an inequality that requires removal by inflicting harm upon the criminal himself? Certainly, if we accept the goodness of private property, for example, we could derive how theft would require the property or something of equal value to be returned, as might be ordered in a civil court. But even if that court awarded further damages to be paid for additional losses, this would still not be punishment on St. Thomas's account. punishment is something altogether different. To put the question differently, society has gained by inflicting harm in the form of punishment upon assailants within its own ranks? To say that justice requires such an infliction merely brings us back to the claim that crime produces a debt of punishment. St. Thomas's argument for which referred us to the natural irascible inclinations for which we still lack an ostensible object compared with the due ends of the concupiscible faculty. For a more fully developed answer to this question, I believe we need to move beyond the text of St. Thomas and to enlist the help of a few contemporary scholars who come to this question from the broad perspective of natural law. For instance, the late Walter Burns, former professor at this university, by the way, the late Walter Burns had argued that at the core of punishment's moral justification is the righteous indignation, so much a part of what St. Thomas calls irascibility and what Plato called thumos. Those who lack such indignation in the subrational parts of their souls, such as the anti-hero Merceau in Camus' The Stranger, are morally defective. And they're morally defective because they are incapable of committing themselves to the common good as human beings. Burns conveys this point by focusing upon the irascible appetite's most punitive passion, namely anger. Anger, he says, is expressed or manifested on those occasions when someone has acted in a manner that is thought to be unjust. And one of its bases is the opinion that men are responsible for their actions and should be held responsible for what they do. Thus, anger is accompanied by the pain caused by him who is the object of anger. But also by the pleasure arising from the expectation of exacting revenge on someone who is thought to deserve it. Anger is a very human passion, not only because only a human can be angry, but also because it acknowledges the humanity of its objects. It holds them accountable for what they do. Criminals, he continues, are properly speaking the objects of our anger. They have done more to inflict an injury upon an isolated individual. They have violated the foundations of trust and friendship, the necessary elements of a moral community. A moral community, unlike a hive of bees or a hill of ants, are one whose members are expected freely to obey the laws and, unlike in a tyranny, are trusted to obey the laws. The criminal has violated that trust, and in doing so has injured not only his immediate victim, but the community as such. If then people are not angry when someone else has robbed, raped, or murdered, the implication is that no moral community exists, because those people do not care for anyone other than themselves. Anger is an expression of that caring, and society needs people who care for each other, who share their pleasures and pains, and do so for the sake of others. The same opinion was expressed more recently by the philosopher Geoffrey Murphy, a philosopher who spent much of his early career defending retributivism against the utilitarian theory of punishment, and who seems to have arrived at the conclusion that the value of retribution just cannot be fully defended or explained without reference to what he calls resentment. In a chapter fittingly entitled, Two Cheers for Vindictiveness, not three cheers, two cheers for vindictiveness, he says, it's important to stress that resentment does not stand simply as emotional testimony to self-respect. This passion also stands as testimony to our allegiance to the moral order itself. We all have a duty to support, both intellectually and emotionally, the moral order, an order represented by clear understandings of what constitutes unacceptable treatment of one human being by another. If we do not show some resentment to those who flout those understandings, we run the risk of being complicitous in evil. Thus understood, retributive punishment is not, as Bentham had dismissed it, a legitimized form of organized vengeance or hatred. It is actually a rebuke or repudiation of the criminal's crime and a reinforcement of our own commitment to the common good. Now granted, God, just as he could have created the sky green and the grass blue instead of the sky blue and the grass green, God could have designed our souls in such a way as to reinforce our commitment to the common good in the wake of crime in some other way, just as he could have designed us to procreate or nourish our bodies in some other way. But the logic of natural law leads us to follow human nature that we have the natural inclinations as best we can discern them. These words, if they resonate, may give us an answer as to the purpose of the natural inclination to punish criminals that St. Thomas believes lies at the heart of retribution's moral basis. However much he believed in the Socratic teaching that no one willingly commits injustice, Plato's Athenian stranger appears willing to concede that thumos, or irascibility, must be given its due. If not in theory, at least in practice. What St. Thomas's natural law teaching seems to affirm is that we might do more than simply put up with or allow concessions to this part of the soul. We might even embrace it upon understanding that, if properly channeled by reason and within a legal or political order, it plays a crucial role in safeguarding the common good, not only by deterring crime or sequestering dangerous people, but by giving expression to and reinforcing that common good itself.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.